Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the show's resident stat guy.
The men's Champions League Final Four is set, and we are creeping closer and closer to playoff time for Love, the PVF, and the NCAA Men's Conference Tournaments. We saw a lot of non-conference play this week on the men's side. I think it's kind of a weird time with some spring breaks, some exam time, depending on what system the schools run. So the teams were traveling all over the place this week. Love only has a couple weeks of play left before the season-ending tournament in Louisville, and there are about 10 regular season games left in PVF before the Final Four is determined there as well. So we're coming down to crunch time, everybody, and we're seeing which teams are rising to the occasion and which ones are crumbling under the pressure. We love to see it both ways. We love the drama. So we have some fun stuff to discuss with you today, and we cannot wait, so let's get started. As I said, the Men's Champions League Final Four is set, which means that the second phase of the quarterfinals took place this week. Zawiercie from Poland beat Lunenburg 3-1, which means they won both matches handily, 3-0, 3-1, so they are through. Perugia had a repeat 3-1 performance against Monza, so they are through. Jastrzębski recovered, as we expected them to. They beat Olympiakos pretty handily, 3-0.
Happy for them that they had their Cinderella run at home, but reality won out in the end.
The team that I feel is, I don't want to say supposed to go, the team that is stronger is going, in my opinion. So since Jastrzębski earned 1 point in their 5-set loss last week, there was no need for a golden set here because they earned 3 points in their 3-0 win. So the final score between Jastrzębski and Olympiakos was 4-2. So Jastrzębski gets to go on free of the golden set. Nobody wants to play one of those. We did have one, though. We did not get away unscathed. So Warsaw beat Halkbank Ankara 3-0. But if you remember from last week, Halkbank won 3-1. And since both of those matches were 3-point wins, we had to go to the golden set. So this match was actually played in Warsaw, and Halkbank won the golden set 15-12. Heartbreaking.
The golden set is always a roll of the dice. It's so entertaining and stressful to watch.
And you lose it at home, too.
Not the best.
But, I mean, it keeps it interesting because, like, it would have been three Polish teams and an Italian team. But now we've got two Polish teams, an Italian team, and Turkish. So the final four matchups are Perugia versus Halkbank and Zawiercie versus Jastrzębski. So that, we've got a bit of a wait here, folks. So that is happening May 16th to 18th in Woods, Poland. So exciting stuff happening on that front. Love a golden set. Hate to play in them, but entertaining stuff.
Great for the fans.
On the NCAA men's side, as we predicted last week, Cal State Northridge had an interesting week, to say the least. You know that I have been scratching my head about how the heck this team is ranked number 7 in the country. So we saw CSUN beat Lewis in 5, and then they turned around and lost to Loyola Chicago in 5.
So let's look at just a few of the numbers from here, because there were some interesting things to look at. So against Lewis, CSUN actually hit 216 versus Lewis's 350. So they probably shouldn't have won that match. Statistically, Lewis looks better in a lot of categories, blocking more digs, or same number of digs roughly, But I think the difference here was where the serving happened. So CSUN had 11 aces and 18 misses.
That's actually pretty good.
It's not bad, especially over five sets.
That's like one ace to like roughly one and a half errors.
Yeah.
That's very good, especially in men's.
But Lewis went 8 service aces to 21 service errors. So even though they hit better, they struggled from the service line to kind of keep consistent pressure, it looks like. And Jalen Phillips had 23 kills in that match and hit 364.
He's their star.
Yeah, so he was very good down the stretch. For Lewis, Oguz had 25 kills and hit 404, and Max Roquette had 16 kills and hit 359. I mean, the scores of this one, minus a couple sets, were close. So it was a pretty good game. And if we look at CSUN versus Loyola Chicago, this was a little less of a serving clinic. We had CSUN had 4 aces to 27 errors. Oh, wait for it. Loyola had 5 aces to 32 errors.
My gosh.
So while this wasn't necessarily the best game to watch, given the sheer amount of serving errors that happened, Loyola Chicago did pull this out 18-16 in the fifth. Now,
yeah, because they're missing every single serve. It's just like point for point.
Well, look at this. CSUN hit 185 on the match.
Oh, my gosh.
And Loyola Chicago hit 237. We had 26 hitting errors for Loyola Chicago and 25 for CSUN.
I hope they refunded everybody's ticket to that match. Oh, my gosh. It's just like error fest.
Now, if we do... So I understand what Loyola Chicago was trying to do here. They were trying to put on service pressure and get blocks against CSUN, which they did. So they had 34 block assists in that match and 3 solo blocks. So
you've got to be joking me right now. That's like 20 team blocks.
Yeah. We are going to go rip it from the baseline, and we're going to block, and we're going to take our chances.
Oh, so my gosh. Is this UCLA?
But like, this the game was
UCLA
a
does.
The game was a barn burner. You had, okay, so I'm going to go with Loyola Chicago scores first in all of these. 25-22, 23-25, 25-23, 23-25, 18-16.
It like could not be closer.
Yeah. So CSUN had a couple of matches against ranked teams, lost a close one. 18-16, won a close one, 17-15. So all of those teams are in the mix.
But do you think CSUN should be ranked 7th?
I think they... Wow. What are Lewis and Loyola Chicago currently ranked?
Okay, so as of the week of March 17th, so the 24th hasn't come out yet, Loyola Chicago was 8. So we expected that one to be close. And Lewis is 15.
I would say, if anything, Lewis should probably be a little higher, although they had a couple bad losses.
Well,
recently,
then they lost. Wasn't it? They lost to Lindenwood last week.
So, I don't know. They're all jumbled together in the middle. I think this puts, you know, those three teams. It should probably be 9, 10, 11.
Well, this just highlights what we've been saying, that you've got like the top five teams that are just in a league of their own.
Yeah,
and then the rest are like decent, but it's just not the same volleyball.
Yeah. I would be curious to see any of these teams play, for example, a Stanford, who, in my mind, is potentially...
But is also of that ilk.
Well, and that's my question. To me, they're a 1B. And are these teams a 1B or are they a 2? Like, is there a little bit of separation there? And, you know, you have Pepperdine, who's got a ton of size. How do these teams deal with that? So there's a couple kind of interesting matchups, let's call them, from those teams who are in the middle of the men's currently.
Ohio State actually had the exact same schedule as CSUN this week. They just traded. And Ohio State lost both of those matches. They are not having a great year. And then BYU and Grand Canyon had a back-to-back series. They split. So BYU won the first match in 4, and GCU won the second one in 3.
Well, that match was interesting. So we watched that one. And
The first one.
And BYU started really strong. So they won the first two sets.
Like badly. It was like 18 and 18.
Yeah. And were up in the third set. And GCU just decided that they had figured it out at that point. GCU came back in the third set, played pretty well, made it close in the fourth, but had definitely found some rhythm and then just kept it rolling and swept the next day.
It was kind of a weird match to watch, to be honest.
Yeah, I would agree with
you. We watched BYU early in the season, and they had some interesting roster switches. They were having trouble scoring. Like, Keone Thima, I think he got blocked literally straight down.
Multiple
60%
times.
Of the time he swung.
Yeah, it was. He had a rough go.
I said this when we watched them earlier this year. They set their balls so high. Yeah. And when you have such an undersized hitter like that, who you want to be your go-to hitter, you need to give him speed because he is getting literally munched.
It's so hard to hit against a well-formed block all the time. And I think he's capable of hitting a faster set. I think they 100%. Need to figure it out. But they haven't yet, so I'm not sure how that's going to go.
Yeah, it was a weird match. Oh, to GCU's credit, they were on the ropes and they held it together. Like, BYU had several match points and they just kept going. And they had their lefty spin server come in, save the day, put together a string of points when it mattered. Ugh, it was interesting, but you got to wonder what's going on here.
If you had to pick between GCU and BYU right now, who would you pick if they were to play in the playoffs?
I think they're pretty even. Like, even though the scores didn't go five and didn't push, I think they're pretty evenly matched.
I think GCU edges them a little bit.
Oh, man. You would, like, on paper, you would think BYU would be better than they are.
Agreed.
And they're just not.
But I think it's because of how they run their offense. I don't think they're maximizing the players that they have.
Those balls are so high for everybody.
Yeah. And GCU seemed to get a beat on their hitters. Like, by the second match, they knew where to position themselves. They knew how to set up the block, what the timing was. They had just settled into the rhythm against that team.
Well, I think GCU runs their middle way better.
Absolutely.
And consistently. Yeah. And, like, they were virtually unstoppable. Like, I really liked how GCU ran their middle, which opened things up. It's not like GCU's outsides are, like,
world beaters.
Crazy, unbeatable hitters. But, like, things open up for them because their middles are so strong.
We always talk about it.
Always talk about it.
If we look at Love this week, we saw a third-place showdown between Madison and Salt Lake, with Madison winning 3-2. Now, we will talk about this game specifically, but this gives Madison third place outright. So we will see if they're able to hang on to that towards the end of the season. In the weekend for Love, Atlanta beat Austin 3-0. Not really a surprise. Omaha continues to lose, losing to Austin 3-2 and Houston 3-1. So they're winless in their last, I'm not sure what the number
is
now.
It's been a while, I think.
On the website, when they show the last four matches, it's just red for Omaha. So they're struggling. Sammy Francis has joined Omaha and looked to have had a pretty good turnout. She scored a whole bunch of points for them. So we'll see. But I think it's just a little bit too late for Omaha.
Well, it's my understanding that Stiverns is injured now, too. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I heard that both Candelaria Herrera and Stiverns are injured, so they had to bring Francis in to, like, have enough middles. And her and Thader led the team in points, which I love to see it. They, like, run that middle, okay? But you need some production from elsewhere. We also saw Jaylee Winters and Jordan Larson started the match, were taken out. It looked like they were running a 5-1, which, why weren't you doing that with Stiverns? But, yeah, Sammy Francis coming back after a couple months since her last game and just like, hey, I'll just get
I mean, I liked
lead
her.
The team.
I liked her. I like what she does. I think she's good for that team. We always talk about running the middles more, which every team probably needs to do, but when you run your middles that much, your outsides need to score.
Because you're going to be one-on-one, everybody, okay?
But we talked about this all season long with Omaha's outside hitting core being questionable in terms of being able to score consistently.
Maybe a little weaker than some of the other combos out there, yeah.
And now you're seeing that with teams kind of figuring out how to defend them well.
But I'm sorry, like, your middles are scoring that way, and, like, pretty sure the players who came in were Kubik and Savard, and they were hitting, like, less than 100.
Yeah, it's
rough, looked like a rough outing.
They need to figure it out in Omaha, but it's too late. They're going to finish at the bottom of the league. They're going to have the worst first and second round matchups if they manage to win. So at this point, it just needs to be about building momentum for that final in 2 weeks. So if we look at the standings for Love, currently it's Atlanta, then Houston, Madison, Austin, Salt Lake, Omaha. Austin and Salt Lake are tied for fourth, so we will see how that plays out. That is now kind of the jockeying for position. Moving on to the PVF, Orlando got their payback against San Diego this week. They won 3-1, but then followed up with a 3-1 loss to Atlanta, which was a match they probably needed to win.
We watched that one.
Give me your thoughts.
I don't know what happened to Brittany Abercrombie. She was useless.
So we are gonna talk about her in our game later on, and we'll dive in a little bit more to where she has been. But she has been on a slide as of late, and it is not trending in a good direction.
I do not get it, because she was so dominant for so much of the season, and she was hitting neutral. She had zero pace on her attacks. She was hitting negative for a lot of the match. And the crazy thing is they kept her in. They would not take her out. And I'm like, you need to make a change here. This is getting wild.
They have to leave her in because they need her to score points.
But she's not scoring points.
Well, I get that, but they need her to figure it out. Because if she doesn't figure it out, they're not going to win.
Well, no kidding. They've been terrible for the last couple weeks.
They rely on her, and I don't know whether it's just been a long season.
But I don't care who you are. Like, at some point, if you're not doing your job, like, let's switch it up. Like, I understand what you're saying. She is their go-to hitter. They need her to figure it out if they want to be successful, but she's not. So at least, like, let's have some accountability here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I hear you. And whatever their coaching decision is, she was not good.
Not good.
And they didn't have anybody else step up in her place to make up for that lack of scoring. They are going to be in trouble if they don't figure
that out. Well, they were missing Adora, too, who has been the other main point scorer for them for most of the season. Like, she didn't even travel.
She actually hasn't been playing that much as of late, so I'm wondering if she's fighting an injury.
Hmm.
Their main outside recently has been Vander Weide and Schwann. And so I'm not sure if Adore has been injured, or if she's fighting something, or if she's got something else going on, but they've been rotating through those three. So that's, again, something they're going to need to figure out in terms of who's going to be able to score points for them.
Atlanta looked pretty good, though.
Yeah, they did well. Beeson is an enigma to me. She sometimes plays well and is great, and other times is just terrible. The good thing is they have a backup in Jones who can come in.
I thought Jones did a good job.
Yeah, so Jones came in, played well. And this to me is actually something that I think is key in PVF right now. If you have a good backup for when someone is struggling, there's been lots of teams that have inconsistent players in one position or more than one. And if you have a legitimate backup that can come in and perform, those teams have been a little more consistent. So the Beeson-Jones pair is functioning well, and I like the strategy they're using. We're going to put Beeson in. We're going to see what Beeson we get. If she's good, we're solid. And Jones, in my opinion, is a little more consistent. And so you've kind of got a good 1-2 punch there.
I think Jones's upside isn't quite as high as Beeson's, but her low side is not as low as Beeson's.
Correct.
And I thought Atlanta's outside combo in Timmer and Edmonds were consistent. I thought Corey Lewis was unstoppable.
MVP.
Like, wow. Wow.
She was very, very good.
Morgan Hentz was solid as always.
Yeah. I'm curious to see. Pia Timmer did well. She was lined up against the setter. Who?
Somebody has to be luckier.
Well, agreed. And to Atlanta's credit, they had a strategy. They set her a ton of balls every time that matchup was there, and she took advantage of it. I'm curious, watching her play against a bigger block, if she'll score that efficiently. But you take what's given, and she did a really good job in that match. In other matches in PVF, Vegas has finally snapped a 7-game losing streak. They beat Grand Rapids in 4. This puts them outside of the playoff window. Now, there's still a decent number of games to play. They have games in hand in the teams ahead of them. I'm curious what Vegas is going to look like moving forward for these last 10 games. So they started incredibly hot. Then they stunk for a very long time. Will they right the ship in the last? I think they have 11 matches left, maybe 12.
People have like 9 to 11 matches
left. So that is going to be interesting because they're going to have to fight for that last playoff spot. We had Indy having a great week, beating Columbus in 5 and then going into Omaha and winning 3-0, which I've always liked Indy.
You've been an Indy fan since the beginning.
So I like to see that. We have some unfortunate injury news. Member Mena and Georgia Murphy are both out for the season. Georgia Murphy ripped every tendon in her knee.
Ligament, but it's fine.
Yeah, every ligament in her knee. And member Mena redid her ankle. Apparently, it's season ending. So we will see how Indy does without her. They looked all right in the last game.
They beat Omaha 3-0.
They beat Omaha. So rallied around her, and we'll see if we can keep going from there. There is a pretty good gap between the top 4 and the bottom 4. Omaha is still comfortably in first. Like we said, Vegas is in 5th with a couple games in hand. So they're kind of fighting for that spot. We're going to talk about this later on in the game as well. And Atlanta and Indy are currently tied for 3rd, but Indy is up in points. So we'll see how that tie break shakes off. Again, still lots of time. We'll see how things shake out in the PVF. But it's actually kind of getting interesting as you watch the games of who's going to make it. I like it.
And we do have, to finish up our weekly happenings, highlights, etc., we do have some follow-ups from some recent questions that we answered in previous episodes. So we have our sources, ladies and gentlemen, and they give me the details. So it has been confirmed that mid-season trades are allowed in PVF. Apparently the deadline for this season is April 1st. There have been a few teams that have collected players. So San Diego has picked up Tara Caesar, who played at Georgia and Florida. Columbus has picked up Nootsara Tomcom, the setter for Thailand.
Orlando, she's been playing forever, right?
Yeah, she's very good. Orlando has acquired Melanie Schaffmaster from Minnesota post her Greek season. And then Atlanta has picked up Mikhail White, who played at Texas. So nothing crazy, but some holes that were identified they're trying to fill with players who have finished or like didn't make playoffs in their foreign seasons. But yes, trades are allowed.
What I'm really curious to see, once the playoff race is kind of settled in, do any teams trade for players to bolster their playoff hopes? Does Vegas make any moves?
Atlanta, somebody did that last year. They traded a player for an earlier draft pick.
I think 2 first-round picks.
Whew.
I can't remember who the player was, but I think she got pregnant right after that too. So that was 2 first-round draft picks for somebody who might be ineligible for the next little while.
Dang. For those of you who are asking what's up with Cammy Miner, she has been reported / told to me that she'll be playing for Verovali Milano next season. She is currently supposed to be the backup for Alessia Oro, but there's some drama brewing in that Fenerbahce wants to buy her out of her contract, this and that. There is some movement happening, so we will see. But yes, Cammy will be playing next season. And we talked about our thoughts on the relaxed doubles calls. Somebody was like, well, what do you think about the relaxed lift calls? Same thing. I think it's messy. I think it's sloppy. I don't like it.
Again, I understand it for younger players, for development, from a TV standpoint. But we're professionals at this point. Again, I agree that it should be part of the skill development. It's always that fine line between entertainment, where you don't want the rallies to end on that play and keeping it going, and knowing what the skills are. I don't mind it being a little lax, but I think it's gone too far.
We really extended our weekly highlights today, so hopefully you stuck with us. There was a lot going on. Lots of news in addition to the results. Yeah, it was a big week. Our first feature match of the week is Love, Madison versus Salt Lake. It was interesting, and I think Salt Lake gave it away.
I don't disagree with you. My initial takeaway watching the match was that it was a match of runs.
Massive. Massive runs.
So I've done some of the kind of going through the sets and picking up scores just because I thought it was interesting. So we'll talk about that as we get into it. Any other overarching thoughts?
I thought that the only player Lauren Carlini could connect with in this match was Annie Schumacher. It was a struggle seeing the left sides try to hit. The middles were not going. So Annie Schumacher was given so many balls. And granted, she did a great job. She basically carried the team offensively. But when you're competing, like, one player scoring against a whole team, like, Salt Lake, you need to figure it out.
Well, I did think that Carlini figured it out a little bit towards the end of the match, and that was the difference. You watched the left sides tip a whole ton of balls.
They physically could not hit the ball. It was crazy.
They were so flat and fast that they couldn't get there. I didn't think the setting was much better, but I thought that she put a little more shape on it for the outsides in the fourth and fifth set, and you started to see them swing a little more. So at least there was an adjustment there. This blows my mind. Salt Lake has very good middles. Haley Washington needs to be set more than anybody else on that team.
She's like unstoppable, you guys.
She hit 619 and had 15 points.
In front of the setter, behind the setter, she is scoring points, so give her the ball.
And the other thing that confuses me, and I've talked about this before, Gray needs to play. She needs to start. She needs to play. They finally brought her in. They set her 10 times. She had 9 points and hit 600. Like, you have the potential to run the best two middle combo maybe in the league there. And Poulter is very good at connecting with the middles. Those two should be the staple of your offense, and it will make everything better. I don't understand why that's not happening.
Me neither. And I agree with you about Gray over Tori Dixon. We have been saying this since the season started. She is more physical. She jumps better. She moves laterally better. She hits better. She gets over the... Like, yes, she's less experienced, but I will take that physicality any day.
But this is the thing that confuses me. So Haley Washington was out at the beginning. So fine, put Tori Dixon in. And Tori Dixon, she's serviceable. She doesn't.
No, it's not like she's like a black hole out there. She's not.
She doesn't make a ton of errors. Like, she's fine. But Gray, she started the season. How did you not see, hey, when we get to the end of the season, our way to winning is to have this 1-2 middle combo? It was a short-sighted decision to me.
Serena Gray has an untraditional arm swing for a middle. It's like a little big. But when she's jumping that high and is able to hit those kind of angles,
who cares?
Does it matter? Doesn't matter. I don't think so.
So that to me is something that just should have happened, needed to happen. We'll see what happens moving forward, but I'm a fan of her. I think she should be playing. Their outside struggled.
Dude, Danny Drews was starting again, and every time I watch her, I'm like, why is she starting? Like, she doesn't do anything for them. She makes a ton of errors. It's so awkward as a lefty on the left side with the speed of ball that Poulter likes to run. She has been a liability in every single match I have watched Salt Lake play.
She does better on the right.
Well, she came in. They finally took her out, and she was coming in for the double sub, and she was doing so much better. So much better.
Yeah, it seems... I think Salt Lake's biggest issue is personnel decisions. When I watch them play, the lineups they put on the floor just don't compute for
me. Do not make sense to me. And you got the best libero in the league, too.
100%.
I'm sorry. Like, this woman is unbelievable. She digs everything. Her passing is solid. She sets well. Like, you have an outstanding setter. You've got a great libero. You've got an incredible, potentially incredible middle duo. Ronnie Jones-Perry, people have been saying that they think she's been so mid all season in Love. I disagree. I think that she has been solid for Salt Lake for the majority of the season. Skylar Fields was out with an injury this match, but Casanova didn't do poorly. I think she did pretty well. So you're missing one of the top scorers in the league in Skylar Fields for that match. But like, you have solid athletes at virtually every position. Like, I don't understand.
Well, not to mention your strength in the middle, and you talk about your passing. Like, Ronnie Jones-Perry is a good passer. Your libero is a great passer. You're in system enough to utilize that. You should be able to make life pretty easy for your outside hitters at that point. And I think the thing, going back to it, about Ronnie Jones-Perry is sometimes she doesn't pass the eye test. Like, if you watch her play, it can seem like she's not contributing or she's not attacking well. But then you go back and look at the stats, and she's put up solid numbers. Like, in this match, she had 29 points. She was set 55 times, and she hit 273.
If you're getting set that many times in a match, hitting 273 is, like, pretty solid.
Yeah, I totally agree. And she's the outside hitter.
The P1.
Yeah, sorry, she's the out-of-system option.
Yeah, exactly.
In there. So you're... which you normally do at the right side. So to have that load as a passing left side as well is even heavier. So I understand people might think that watching her, but if you look at the numbers, she's been good. Okay, before we get into looking at Madison, I want to go over some of the scores that happened or some of the runs that happened in this match. So we'll start set one. Pretty close to start. Madison is up 17-14 in the first. I blinked, and then it was 17-20.
Yeah.
For Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. So we had two Franklin hitting errors, a Chassé hitting error, Drews got blocked, and then two passing errors by Chassé. You give up 6 points in a row, and then the game ended at 20-25 for Salt Lake. So you went from being up 17-14 to losing 25-20.
Just a solid 11-3 run, no biggie.
Like that... that should not happen.
No. You're talking about three hitting errors from the left sides. They couldn't hit the ball.
I mean,
I'm not making excuses for them, but I'm just, it's highlighting the connection issues that we were seeing.
Correct. But regardless, as a team, you can't do that.
No.
So then they come out in the second set, and we get off to a 15-4 start.
The other way, yes.
For Madison.
It's like, what?
And that game ends 25-15.
Yeah.
Like, what is happening in those situations? It's crazy to me. And again, we start in the third set, and pretty close, teams battling. It's 14-15 for Madison. Then they give up three, so it's 14-18. And then they lose 17-25. Like, and this is...
I'm just laughing because it's just like... ridiculous. And at one point they did, you know, one of those let's interview the player during a timeout, you know what I mean? But yeah, like not live, it was like pre-recorded at their practice. I believe it was Ronnie Jones-Perry, and she's like, you know what, something that I think is so great about this league is that like there are so many runs. I think it's like so crazy, like anybody could win at any time. There's just like, you're never out of it. There's always runs. And I'm sitting here being like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because like you're professional athletes. Like you need to get it together. Like that's a red flag to me.
Yeah. I know we talk about this and I know people don't like hearing about it, but to me, those runs is one of the things that denotes like top leagues from mid-tier leagues.
And I mean, they happen. They do happen. But I think the frequency and consistency that we see them happen in Love is just like my mind's exploding.
But let's finish the game here.
Okay, just for sorry. I remembered that interview and I just had to say it because I was watching it like, that's not a good thing.
Well, so if we look at set four, Madison starts down 5-10.
Okay, yeah.
They close the gap to 12-14. So they're within 2 points in the middle of the set, which is fine. They end up being down 21-24 at the end of that set. And they end up winning that one. I think like 32-30 or
it was
something
high. It was like, 29-27, something like that.
And that was on the back of a Schumacher serving run. Like, good for her to go back. She put pace on the serve. Like, they earned those points. But Assault Lake, what are you doing? It's 24-21.
You literally had three chances.
Yeah.
To win this match. Like, three side-out opportunities.
And so you blow that set as Salt Lake. And then you come out in the fifth, and it's 4-4. Great. We're having a good fifth set. It's entertaining. And again, I blinked, and it's 11-4 for Madison.
Absolutely crazy.
I will say, from an entertainment standpoint, you literally had no idea what was going to happen.
None.
And it was a wild match to watch. I thought Salt Lake was the better team, to be honest. I thought they should have won that match.
I'm like, you can hear the frustration in my voice. I'm just like, I do not understand what is going on. Because it makes no sense to me.
And I think from a Madison standpoint, I don't really know what to make of them right now. I thought Carlini struggled in that game. Now, she's very good all around. She's good serve, good defensively, puts up a good block. She digs a ton of balls. She sets Annie Drews well, which is important for that team. But I saw her overset Hall.
No, underset. Hall was like jumping and hitting from like her chest.
But that was after she had two balls that kind of went over top of her. Mm. So Hall connected well at the beginning. I was like, okay, good. They're setting her. This is what they need to do. And then that connection disappeared. And then the left side had to tip a ton of balls. They cycled through. Yaniska was in. Franklin was in. Chassé
was in.
It was
a revolving door of those three the whole match.
And I didn't think that was entirely fair because I didn't think the left side's got a chance to be put in a position to be successful. There was no rhythm there. And they'll have to figure that piece out because that's not going to be good enough to win against the top two teams if that's their goal. The game was entertaining. You know, there were good plays.
The sheer unpredictability of it.
Yeah, 100%. Like if you're not looking at necessarily what should happen or the swings. And this is the interesting part for me. Like, if you're a Nebraska fan and Nebraska plays like this, you're up in arms about the inconsistency about what you're doing. Like, you have to hold your professionals to the same standard.
Even a higher standard. Well, yeah, they're more experienced. They're getting paid. I understand college people are getting paid to play now, too. But you know what I mean.
This to me, and kind of in stark contrast to having watched the Women's Champions League quarterfinals like a couple weeks before, there were some very good rallies, some very high-level play, but it was intermittent. And the runs were wildly entertaining and somewhat perplexing.
But that's the thing. It's like, if you are a casual volleyball watcher, you probably will look at that and be like, this is amazing. Like, wow, look at this comeback. Look at this like huge lead, blah, blah, blah. But like for me personally, like watching it with a critical eye, and like I struggle to watch that because I'm just like seeing these inconsistencies and these decision-making issues and things like that that just like make me scratch my head.
From a high-level volleyball perspective, a little head-scratching, but again, an entertaining match to just sit and watch. All right, our last feature match for this episode is going to be PVF Omaha versus Indy. Hit me with your initial thoughts.
I thought Indy, having lost their go-to player, their quote-unquote franchise player, I wasn't sure what to expect. But I think the way that they rallied as a team and the way I saw different athletes step up individually was really cool. I thought, you know, Teeler kind of put the team on her back.
She played very well.
She was outstanding. And even though there were some like passing and defensive hiccups along the way, I think their defensive system was solid. We haven't seen Omaha play for a little bit, but I was underwhelmed on the Omaha side. I felt like the players had trouble getting going. Indy looked dominant to me.
Well, and let's highlight Teeler here. She was set 33 times. She had 19 kills and hit 515 on the match. Like, that's
really good.
She was unconscious and unstoppable.
Really good. And I have been critical of her this season. But she stepped up and Omaha did not have an answer.
No.
In particular, when they're running the combo play, like, you guys, every single time Indy runs a combo play, they set Teeler. Like, let's just be ready for that. Because I was getting so frustrated.
Omaha was not ready for that.
They were not ready for that. Okay?
I thought the other thing, well, this was interesting. So we've talked about Indy's middles. And I thought they started running Crawford often at the beginning of the match. And she was actually scoring. Mm-hmm. But then that part kind of went away. She struggled later in the match. They stopped setting her. That connection disappeared. She looked like Crawford from earlier in the season. I like that they're trying to work on that. If they can figure that part out, if they have a consistent threat in the middle, because Martin had a good game, and if Crawford can score too, I really like what Indy's doing.
I thought Crawford's offense earlier in the match was the best I've ever seen her swing.
Yeah, but it reverted at the end.
Which I think if you're making improvements, that's to be expected. But the last time we spoke about Indy, we were saying, like, if they want to, like, be at the top, they need to run their middles and they need to get Crawford going because she's a non-factor. She was putting way more pace on the ball. She was staying behind the ball. Like, the work had been done and she looked way better, albeit for half the match.
Yeah, both her and Martin got 14 sets each. So it was a conscious effort and they need to keep going with that, but it was noticeable and beneficial, I thought.
And when I'm speaking about Indy's, like, block defensive strategy, I think their middles are incredible blockers. I think their right side tandem in Sydney Hilly and Teeler were blocking very well.
Yeah.
I was pulling my hair out watching their left sides block. You guys, Emily Londot does not hit angle, okay? She hits line, and that's about it. And they were leaving her line on every single ball. And let me tell you, it wasn't getting dug. So it's not like you're leaving a channel for your libero to make digs. Like, shut down the line. I was getting so frustrated, I couldn't handle it.
Player issue or coaching issue? What's your instinct?
My assumption is that they planned to leave her the line so Elena Scott could dig it. But after it happens a few times and you're not picking that up, you need to change the plan and be like, hey, let's completely shut down the line here and force her to go in a direction she doesn't want to. You can't keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. Like, you need to make adjustments.
Well, and it's interesting because Londot's line swing is not a true line swing. It's about 5 feet inside the court from the sideline. And so when you leave her that space, she's actually got quite a window to hit. And they needed
as a right-handed right side, yeah.
Yeah, they needed to. It was too much area for Scott to pick up. And I know she's very good, but it's too much space.
But the kicker is, like, Omaha was not setting their middle.
Agreed.
So, like, why are you pinched in so far as a left side to help the middle that Omaha does not set?
And they didn't run very many pipe balls.
Exactly. It's like, get outside to make sure you can shut down the line. Like, what are you looking for here? I don't know. It just, like, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. Granted, Indy 1-3-0, so what the heck am I even talking about here?
Well, Omaha didn't play particularly well. If they're going point for point with you, those are the kind of adjustments that makes the difference between, like, beating really good teams and beating teams when they're not playing their best.
True.
Because Allie Batenhorst struggled in that match.
She got pulled in the first set or second set?
I think second
early,
set.
Regardless.
Yeah. I mean, she got 17 sets. She had 3 kills. She was blocked twice, 2 hitting errors for hitting negative 059.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you just can't. Those can't be your numbers for your starting outside.
Yeah, that's rough. And they weren't setting their middles. Nunaviller started, I think in the first 2 sets, she was hitting 500 or something. Yeah. And then they were clamping down on her in the 3rd set. And she struggled a little bit more.
Yeah, they figured her out. She got 38 sets, hit 184, 13 kills, was blocked 4 times. And again,
so you're going from 400 or hitting 500 after like half the match to it drops to one, whatever, you just said 148 or something, 84. Like,
and that's what happens when you don't run your middle and you know where the ball is going. Like, if we talk about distribution, and I mean, I guess Emily Londot got a bunch of sets as well. You had Nunaviller got 38 sets, Londot got 28, and then Reagan Cooper was the next one at 16, if you don't consider Batenhorst.
She's the one who came in for Batenhorst.
Yeah, so like, what are we talking about middle wise? Kayla Caffey got 11 sets, maybe.
And I'm shocked because I do not remember her hitting that many balls.
Yeah.
Like, watching the match, I was like, why aren't they setting the middle?
Now, talk to me about their setter.
Valentin Anderson?
Yeah. How do you think she did?
She was fine. Like, watching the game, I didn't necessarily see her as, like, a huge liability. What I feel like you have thought.
I was just curious of the decision-making of the offense she run. Like, do you think they passed well enough to run more middle?
Well, I understand that the middles that they have are traditionally blocking middles. Like, they've never been huge offensive middles, but that doesn't matter. Like, you can't rely on one or two hitters to get the job done. Like, you need to feed them a little more consistently.
Yeah, I agree. They need to figure out how to own the middle of the court a little bit. I mean, if I didn't have the context of the current standings, if Omaha wasn't in first place, I would say Indy is the better team from a one match standpoint. And I know that doesn't count. I know it doesn't really mean much, but you always measure yourself against the top team. And I really liked what Indy's doing. I can see what they're working on. I can see where they want to head. And I mean, obviously Omaha has good outsides and they put up better numbers, but from a sustainable offensive standpoint, again, snapshot one game, it is what it is. It's just, hey, we're going to rely on these players. We'll see what happens with that.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see too with these lineup changes and role changes on the Indy side as teams get video and have an understanding of what their game plan kind of looks like now without Member Mena in the lineup. Like, is that going to be sustainable? Are they going to be able to maintain that? Because Carly Scott, she's come in now and then as a sub, but she hasn't really consistently been playing full matches. So, and I think she definitely held her own.
She had 19 attacks, 8 kills, hit 316.
Yeah, so she did solid. Is Teeler going to be able to maintain that level of production? Is Scott going to be able to stay consistent like that? Are they going to be able to get CeCe Crawford going? Or there's a lot of variables at play here, but for that particular match, I think Indy looked really good.
I'm curious on the Omaha personnel side. Like, in the middle, you have Alawayo and Onabanjo in the middle who didn't play. And again,
but
I know.
But have they played at all season? Like, have they gotten in at all?
I think Onabanjo has played a little bit.
Really?
I'm not 100% sure. And again, I know that
they're... But Phoebe is not an attacking middle either. Like, Minnesota did not use her. Onabanjo...
Could be.
...is... can score.
I'm looking at the personnel they have and saying, okay, how... If I'm that team currently, and again, based off this match, we need to be more of a threat in the middle.
And again, we're basing it off of this match. Yeah, like, 100%. Maybe they set their middle all the time and they just weren't. But I don't know.
But this, again, this is against a playoff team. Indy's in the top four. Like, you would think that this is a match that you're circling and saying, hey, you know, we want to play. It's potentially a first round matchup in the playoffs.
Well, especially playing at home, you get blanked.
Yeah, we'll see. I enjoyed watching Indy. I thought they played well. It was interesting to see them against the top team. You can feel the urgency coming in PBF, I think, watching those teams and watching those matches. And Omaha's in a great place. They have less urgency than anybody else. But it'll be interesting to see what happens down the stretch here with those top four or five teams. All right, for our game this week, we're going to play Pavin's percentages. So I am going to give you a couple scenarios, and you're going to tell me what percentage you give it to be true, okay?
Okay.
So we're going to stick, and we're going to start with the PVF. We have a top four in the PVF currently of Omaha, Orlando, Atlanta, and Indy, okay? Now, Omaha's 12-5, Orlando's 12-7, Atlanta's 11-8, Indy is 11-8. Vegas is the next team at 8-9. They have 11 games left to play, and Orlando, Atlanta, and Indy all have 9. What is the percentage that the playoffs are going to be some combination of Omaha, Orlando, Atlanta, and Indy?
80%.
Ooh, that's high.
Vegas has been on like a downslide, and to make up that point differential or that like those matches that they're behind, I think it's going to be tough because, yeah, you can win like 3 matches, but the other teams are probably going to win matches too. I feel like the top four is going to stick. 80%, sure.
Okay. I like that. I agree with your assessment. I think it's probably going to be a high number. I probably would have gone 75 just because I think
a whole Vegas, 5% less. 70, wow.
75. Well, Vegas has the potential to be streaky as we've seen, but I like your assessment there. Okay. Moving on. We talked about this briefly with Lector member Mena out indefinitely for the rest of the season. What do you think is the decrease, if any, that Indy sees in their win percentage? So basically, you're replacing her with Carly Scott. What do you think the decrease in points had she stayed healthy be?
Because you can never predict how people are going to respond to a situation like that. And we've seen people step up. You see some people crumble. I mean, she is one of the top point scorers in the league. Okay, if I'm thinking of what they're losing and potentially what they're gaining by other players stepping up, I'll say 15%.
Okay.
Is that too high? I don't know.
No, I was going to go 25.
Whoa!
I think she's been that good for them. I think she allows her teammates to slot into really good positions. And Teeler did a great job at the right side, but teams are going to figure her out, I think. I think it's going to be really hard. I think both her and Carly played really well against Omaha, and I think that that's going to be tough to do. They still have a lot of games to play. People are excited to play different position, new player come in. I think they're going to feel that loss down the stretch. Okay, we talked about this before, but we're going to go to Orlando's Abercrombie. Okay, I'm going to throw you some stats here of her last 6 matches. Okay, so this is in her 6th match, she hit 431, then she hit 318, then she hit 224, then she hit 136, 149, and in her last match, 024. Okay, that is incremental from 6 to her most recent.
It's pretty definitive. Yes.
What do you think the percentage chances she will bounce back before the end of the season and get above a 250 hitting percentage consistently?
Watching her, I can't figure out if she's been like overused and she's just tired. Like, she has no pace on her balls. She's not hitting any angles at all. 250, like, that's decent. It's not like outstanding. 250? What's the percent chance that she'll hit 250?
Like, that will be her kind of average from here till the end of the season.
50%?
I'm lower on that.
Oh, I just don't know. I want to be like, girl, figure it out, but
I'm 35% on that.
Really?
That's a 6-match sample size of you getting worse and worse and worse.
Progressively worse.
And, you know, I want to give her the benefit of the doubt because she started the season.
It's hard to hit 250. I know that might sound like an elitist statement, but it's like, it's not, hitting 250 is not unreasonable.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how they use her. It depends what situations they put her in. But I, like you said, to me, the troubling thing was there just wasn't a lot of pace on her ball. Like, it's not like she's making mistakes that much. She's just getting dug a ton. Neutral angles, not hitting hard enough. I just wonder if they've either A, used her too much, or she's fighting with some sort of overuse injury. It just doesn't, it hasn't looked good, and the numbers don't look good. All right, and the last, it's a 2-part question. We'll look at Love here. What do you think the percentage chance is that Atlanta finishes first? So they have 2 matches left. They play Houston and they play Omaha. I believe they're 2 wins ahead of Houston, who's the only team who can catch them. Mm. What percentage chance do you think they finish first?
Like 85%, 90%. Like, even if they lose to Houston, I'm pretty confident they'll beat Omaha. How many matches does Houston have left?
2 as well, I believe.
Yeah, I'll say 90%.
Yeah, I was going to go 100 on that one. I'm going to guarantee that. But here's the interesting part of the question. What percent chance do you give Houston to win the whole thing?
65%.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Houston has been my pick since early, and they haven't let me down.
Yeah, I was going to say probably 60. I like them a lot. Atlanta, well, we'll see if they can keep swinging. And they have a very aggressive outside hitting core. Matty Boggs been doing a good job. But Houston just, they've been able to pull out the wins when it mattered. And I think they have a bit of a psychological edge against them currently, too. So anyway, that's Pavin's percentages. I hope you had fun with that. I like that one.
It is time for listener questions. We had a lot of good ones this week, so I had to save some good ones for future episodes, but they are coming. So first question is, these questions kind of combined and were related, so it's a very long two-part question, but have you heard anything about a conflict and or unification of Love and PVF? What do you think should be the expectations between major league owners as the game grows? And that kind of ties into a question about, like, what the heck happened to the MLV? Are they waiting until the end of Love PVF to come out with more statements, or what is going on?
So I haven't heard anything specifically about a merger between Love and PVF. If we look at historically other women's leagues, and I'm referenced mostly hockey here, is the two different leagues, they haven't been around long enough to prove which one is successful. They have two very different models. They have two very different approaches. There is, in my opinion, no clear path to joining those leagues in the near future. It's going to have to be who can generate revenue, who can make it self-sustaining, you know, which model generates fans, TV contracts, all of that. There's, if I had to guess, a decade worth of jockeying for position before either one of them will kind of say, hey, you know, we need to make this a unified thing for the betterment of the sport.
So then what do you think the expectations should be between major league owners as the game grows?
Like between Love and PVF, the people who own the league?
Yeah.
Nothing. I think that they can help find places for athletes to play, but there's just, they're both doing their own thing. They're both focused on growing their own game. They obviously are probably talking and looking and trying to learn from each other, but I don't think there's any cooperation happening. I think they want their league to be the best.
But like what you see in other countries and stuff is like the national federation is at the kind of the top, and then there are branches of different levels. And I understand USA Volleyball is like at the top of both of these leagues, but they're like completely different entities. So what I think would be interesting is if they kind of ran it the way you see overseas, where you can be promoted or demoted from one league to another based on your finish of the year before. And that's what you see, like there's typically like an A league, B, C, D, and like if you win the B, you get to play A next year. If you come bottom of A, you have to go down to B. And I think that would be cool if like the bottom team in Love has to go to PVF and like the winner of PVF gets to play in Love. But like with the overlap of cities and stuff like that, like it's just not realistic. So I don't know. I think they're just two completely different products and it's hard.
Well, I mean, I agree that that would be a great kind of,
especially because USA Volleyball is supporting both.
But you don't have individual team owners, and like even from a structural standpoint, I'm saying like
that would be interesting. I did not say it was feasible.
Yeah. If MLV actually happens and they put as much money in, and all of the promises that they have said from their one press conference,
from their one statement, are just true, bashing everybody,
and they bring in all of the best players in the world, and you have the top league in the U.S., like that with individual owners could be a tier one, tier two with PVF.
Yeah.
Now, there's a little bit of sarcasm in my voice around that, but that's a situation I could see going in that direction.
But also, where did they go? You're coming out and you're literally like going to stomp on everything that these other leagues are doing, and then you just disappear? So the person who asked this question was like, do you think the Supernovas ownership will have to go back to PVF with their tails between their legs? Can you imagine?
It will be interesting to see what happens when PVF season
finishes. I literally don't know what happened.
Haven't heard anything. And again, we reached out to them and asked for an interview or a comment, never heard anything back. So,
and they are apparently starting in January.
Yeah.
They better get to work.
Yeah.
Question two, are there any standout players for you guys in the PVF that you think could play at a higher level in Love or another league? Thinking further ahead, do you think there will be a lot of players switching between the two leagues and we could see a level change as a result?
Well, there's a lot of pieces to that question. Okay, without having done any prep work on this, I think the first person that kind of sticks out, I think Brooke Nunaveller could play.
Really?
I think she could play in another league. I think she passes well enough to be a P2 with some offensive upside. And so I think that there's some potential there. You know, you have to get used to the ball coming a little faster and doing all that. And maybe she starts as a bench player, as a like the third left side and works away. And I think she has potential to potentially play in another league.
I would say Morgan Hentz.
Yeah, I think Morgan Hentz has a shot.
I think Corey Lewis, honestly, should be considered. She's very good. And yep. She has no experience serving or playing defense or anything. And, like, she's figuring it out. I just think she's so physical. I think she could go somewhere else.
I think Natalie Foster.
You love her?
I think she's good.
I don't know.
But think about
it. I think PVF is where she belongs.
I think she has potential. I think she's a pretty good blocker. I think offensively she needs to be a little bit better. She's got a really good serve, which some teams could use. I'm not talking hopping straight into A1 Italy, but I'm saying I think there's a ceiling there where there's potential. And there are other players who are good, but I think their size limits them from going up and playing in the next kind of tier.
I mean, Brittany Abercrombie has played in different leagues up until this point. I think if we're seeing her level from earlier in the season, yes, she could for sure play somewhere else.
So those would be the ones that kind of come to the top of my head.
Yeah, I didn't tell Adam about this question beforehand. And honestly, I wanted to go in just like thinking blind as well. But I feel like a lot of the PVF athletes are playing at a level where they fit.
Yeah.
But there are a few, there's a handful that I think could either pursue something overseas or try to work their way into Love. I honestly don't really see there being a lot of players switched between Love and PVF. I don't think we're going to see mass back and forth. I think the levels of the two are going to kind of stay differentiated.
Love personally kind of has a moat around it. They have to be invited into the league. I think they're going to identify their top couple college players every year and pull them in and then see if they can pull in a few international players. I see that level probably staying very similar to where it is. The one thing I will say is I think PVF can do a better job of identifying college players that have either underperformed in college or maybe weren't in the best spot, didn't have the most opportunity, or came to the sport late. I think my understanding is they let a lot of athletes come to them instead of going out and looking at them. So having a scouting kind of piece for that, I think, would make a big difference for them.
Question three is, which Love rookie has made the most improvements so far this season? Franklin, Skinner, or Mrzyk?
My instinct is Mrzyk.
That's what mine was too. I understand Skinner switched positions and it's different, but you're not seeing her do anything different other than hitting on the right side. Franklin, I'm seeing the same things. I'm not seeing her add elements to her game. I feel like she's playing the same way she was in college. Mrzyk, I think the thing working in her favor is that she has got a very good and very experienced coach working with her. And she was crafty and she was moving the ball around during the college season, but I feel like she is finding different tools to make her game more well-rounded and more suited to maybe an international style.
So I think with Franklin coming into the season, what I was looking for is your passing going to get better? I'm not sure that it has. You know, they sub her out. It's not, it's still a weakness. And that was, for me, what needed to happen. I also don't think Carlini sets her particularly well. So I think that part makes it challenging for her. For Skinner, I was looking at her finding some different angles and hitting against bigger blocks and finding different ways to score other than just being physical. And I think she's still kind of playing the same way. And again, the position change is tough to judge. But again, I think your assessment of Mrzic was accurate, and that was my choice.
Our final question of the week is, what do you think about the volleyball broadcasters? Who are your favorite play-by-play and color commentators? For the women's games in the U.S., are you tired of hearing about NFL and NBA dads, hearing football terms like red zone and quarterback every single game, and that you have to win by two? For part two of that question, yes. I understand they're trying to keep viewers' interest, but like, I don't know when the term red zone started being used so frequently. I mean, they like to talk about the like famous family members and parents. Like, it doesn't drive me crazy. I understand that they're trying to, you know, make it relatable for everybody watching, but it happened. I mean, those comments happen a lot.
I think what I've realized this year is that the commentating for the matches plays a huge role in your enjoyment of the match.
I agree.
My favorite, Paul Sunderland.
He's my favorite play-by-play too.
He is fantastic. He does an incredible job of telling you what's happening and also giving you a little bit of volleyball knowledge about it. Like, that was a bad set. Or
yeah, that was honest.
Totally. He's honest about that. And he has a very unique way of highlighting a player's past experience, making them look good, but putting it into context.
Keeping it within context of the match and the league that they're playing in. I agree. He does such a good job and he's so knowledgeable, but it doesn't seem like too much.
Yeah. So he is hands down my favorite play-by-play guy.
Yeah.
I'm not going to include you on my analyst list.
Adam has to say me. Just kidding.
I honestly think Holly McPeak does a really good
Holly
job.
I like Holly McPeak too.
And I think she does a lot of games with Paul. Like, their dynamic is very good. I would say my overarching issue with analysts is they turn into play-by-play after the fact. I don't think the majority of analysts do a good job of telling you why something happened or what shift should happen. If you watch other sports, the analysts are talking about decision making, what broke down in that play, how this happens. And I haven't heard a lot of good analysis in the volleyball matches.
Yeah, I would agree. You hear a ton of analysts just basically repeat what happened in the play. And it's like, yeah, we know that was a good swing. We know that was a good set. Like,
what did that hitter see? Yeah. Why did they make that decision? What is the block doing? Like, those detail pieces, I find analysts have a hard time talking about.
Those would be my top two.
Yeah, agreed.
We watch a lot of volleyball, and I know you're going to be shocked to hear this. We're pretty critical even of the play-by-play and the analysts. But, yeah, they really can make or break your experience. And we've been talking about this extensively, and we'll dive into it probably in a couple of weeks as we do some league wrap-ups and whatnot. But Paul Sunderland is
hands down the best one, in my opinion. All right, that was an extremely long episode. I hope you stuck around. I hope you enjoyed it. We had fun. If we move forward and look at what is coming up this week, the Love head-to-head match is on Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern between Houston and Atlanta. You know what? We haven't seen those two teams play enough recently.
Oh, my gosh.
So you can see that on Love Live, which generally is YouTube or DAZN. The Weekend with Love is in Austin on Friday and Saturday, and these matches are all on ESPN+. In NCAA men's action, Pepperdine and UCLA have their series on Thursday. That's at 10 o'clock Eastern. And Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern, that is on Big Ten Plus. UC Irvine and Long Beach State play Friday at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern and Saturday at 9 o'clock Eastern.
I'm excited for those.
Are both on ESPN Plus. And if you watch no other volleyball this week, watch those matches. McKendree and Ball State play on Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern. McKendree is the knockoff team or knockout team or the upset
the
team.
The giant killer, maybe.
So they're always fun. They're always fun to watch. PVF, Friday, 7 p.m. Eastern, San Diego plays Atlanta on Volleyball World TV. And on Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern, Indy plays Orlando, playoff implications. And that will be on their YouTube channel.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.